My name is Moina Bill. I'm a consultant anaesthetist up in the Royal, working in cardiac surgery and intensive care. And it's a great honour and privilege to be asked to introduce Professor John Wyatt, whom I happen to have known since 1978. That ages both of us, really, John, doesn't it? He is now Emeritus Professor of Ethics and Perinatology, so looking after the very smallest of the human beings and the very earliest born, so neonates, and he spent most of his working life doing that. He was working in University College in London, first of all trained and then became a professor there. But it was in 1997, I think, I realised where I saw that the London Institute of Contemporary Christianity had a series of lectures on matters of life and death, and John did those. And out of that came his book, which some of you, I'm sure, have. And is it on sale here, Stafford? No, they haven't got any here yet, but I'm sure you can get it in lots of places. It's now into its second edition, and it has been translated into 10 languages throughout the world. So you can see the impact that this has in terms of trying to help people think through the issues in medical ethics, of which the topic that we're looking at today is one. If you read his book, and if you talk to him, you'll realise that he not only knows the theory and has thought a lot about it, but he's walked with the parents and the families through difficult times, both as a clinician and through his church and others as a friend. So he is not one of these professors in their high places of office that doesn't come down to earth and is with normal mortal human beings. And so you'll see as he talks to us that it's couched in reality, the reality of the difficulty or the difficulties that come with being human beings. But I've known him as a friend as well, and he's also got lots of time to sit and chat over a cup of coffee, to ask how things are going in individual lives, and to share some of his own trials and things that happen in life. We actually saw each other last weekend at a prayer summit. He was a bit worried what I might say about him. But one of the things I realised again, as he was involved in organising this prayer summit for the Christian Doctors, Christian Medical Fellowship, and was his ability to look at what's happening in society today and also to think a little bit of what might happen in the future and to think about applying scripture to that and looking at it in the light of God's word, just like his great friend John Stott would have taught us to do. So John, you are very welcome. It's great to have you here, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say to us.
Thanks very much, Marla. Well, thank you very much. It's a real privilege to be here and to take part in this really interesting, stimulating, challenging day. I'm going to try and talk about some of the pastoral and medical challenges, thinking particularly from a Christian perspective. As you've heard, I spent most of my clinical life actually as a baby doctor, working with the very smallest babies. I had the enormous privilege of knowing John Stott as a very close friend, and I became his informal personal physician. The fact that I was a baby doctor was not wasted on us. We used to tease one another, and he would ask me some very private, personal medical problem. What did I think about this or that? And I would say, well, what do I know? I'm a baby doctor. I'm very good at nappy rash. And he would say, I hope it hasn't come to that yet, dear brother. But for those of you who don't know, John Stott was a very distinguished Christian leader in central London and one of the giants of the Christian faith of the 20th century. And one of his concerns and he would die well. And he used to say to us, pray for me that I would die well. And he did. He died well. He did become very disabled and debilitated and dependent. But he was learning through this experience of dependence. And if you're interested, his book called The Radical Disciple, he has two chapters at the end describing his experience of dependence and of his approaching death, writing out of his own personal experience. It's not a tiny button. Sorry. Could you advance it for me? Thanks very much. So next one. So, as we are well aware, the House of Lords is debating at the moment this legislation, so-called assisted dying legislation. Unlike the first two speakers, I don't have an inside track at all. It's fascinating to hear them talking. I found it extremely helpful and instructive. I'm looking on from outside as an observer. Next slide. But one of the things I want to focus on, quite a lot of the things I'm going to say, the issues have already been raised, but I'd just like to focus on some of these points and emphasize them. And the first one is the importance of language. It's fascinating that this word, euthanasia, literally good death, one of the first uses of that word, it was in 1870, when chloroform was a relatively recent discovery of anesthesia. And lo and behold, in all cases of hopeless and painful illness, it should be the recognized duty of the medical attendant, whenever so desired by the patient, to administer chloroform or such other anesthetic as may by and by supersede chloroform, so as to destroy consciousness at once and put the sufferer to a quick and painless death. And that procedure was called euthanatos, a good death. Next slide. So it's interesting to see how often language is being manipulated and used in a euphemistic way. These are all phrases that have been used to describe either killing or assisted suicide, intentional medical killing. Ensuring a dignified death, the right to die, the right to choose at the end of life, easing the passing, assisted dying, choosing to die, easeful death, ending suffering when it becomes unbearable. People should not have to suffer against their will, choice and control over how we die. So it's extraordinarily interesting. Why do people bother? Why is it so important to use language in this euphemistic way? And I think an interesting theme in the history of medical ethics is that so often the manipulation of language precedes the change in behaviour. And I think this reflects how important it is to us as moral agents that the language that we use when we describe our own actions, when we think about other people's actions. Did I kill my patient? No, I was just easing the passing. Oh, that's all right then. So I think it's really important to notice how language is used. This organization used to be called the Voluntary Euthanasia Society. And lo and behold, they changed their name. And of all things, they called themselves Dignity in Dying. And if you go on the website, you'll see Your Life, Your Choice, Dignity in Dying campaigns for greater choice, control, and access to services at the end of the life. We believe that people should have more control over how, where, and when they die. Greater choice includes giving mentally competent, terminally ill adults in unbearable suffering the choice of an assisted death within strict legal safeguards. Dignified death, patient choice. Those words, these mantra, come time and time again. And if you didn't know, you wouldn't know necessarily what they were talking about. It all sounds great until you discover that, again, they're talking about medical killing, intentional killing, either directly by doctors or at one remove as physician-assisted suicide. Next slide. And I think, as has already been said, I mean, the use of this term, assisted dying, for the prescription and administration of intentionally lethal medication, I think that's just consistent with the manipulative use of language in mercy killing for more than a century. And it's interesting how resistant the proponents are to ever refer to suicide and how determined they are to cling to this term despite its ambiguous and misleading nature. Next slide. So I like this proverb, the beginning of wisdom is to call things by their proper name. How we can't really analyze and
assess actions unless we call them by their proper names. As we've already heard, fear is a very major part of the process and one of the great driving forces. And this is now a slightly old survey, but it's just striking. Britain as a nation are terrified by death. A poll carried out by the New Scientist magazine found that 67% of British people were petrified by the prospect of dying. Strong words. And actually, if you ask people how they would like to die, I think you can predict the commonest answer you'll get. I would like to die in the middle of the night, fast asleep, without any kind of awareness, without any kind of warning, any kind of premonition, just to go out like a light, bam, wouldn't that be wonderful? I can see several people nodding their heads. And actually, if you were to ask Christian people that question, by and large, that's the same answer you'll get. And yet, you know, if you were to go back a few hundred years, you would find that for Christian people, that was the worst possible way to die. Sudden death was regarded as the greatest evil to pray against. Every Christian prayed against sudden death. To be catapulted into the presence of your Maker without any prospect, any of preparation, any opportunity to say goodbye, any opportunity to ask for forgiveness from your nearest and dearest and those you had hurt, any opportunity of passing on to the next generation, passing on what you would like them to do and how you would like them to think of you and what your greatest concerns were, to just go out like a light. What a terrible way to go. So isn't it interesting that why is it that we as a modern generation have decided that just to go out without any warning, without any preparation, is actually the best way to die? And I think that's an interesting question. I think it reflects a number of both our individualism, the fact that we're really most concerned about who our own selves and we're not really thinking about everybody else, and it also there's a lack of a loss of a concern about what might happen after we die. So, again, this has already been discussed, but I think there are at least three, these are at least three of the great fears behind this push, both for assisted suicide and for euthanasia. There's fear of suffering. One of the phenomena, I think, that's happened to our modern age is that most of us have lost the belief that suffering, any kind of suffering, pain, deprivation, could have anything positive about it at all. Suffering is seen as something entirely negative, entirely destructive, entirely life-diminishing. And, of course, in certain moral philosophies, particularly in utilitarianism, suffering is regarded as the greatest moral evil. And therefore, it's not surprising that we've lost the belief that suffering could possibly have any positive value. And it's interesting that for modern people, many modern people, the greatest possible good is anesthesia. Just put me out, doc. I don't want to know anything about it. Baroness Finlay talked about this, about going to the dentist. Just put me out. I don't want to know. I don't want to experience anything about it. Anesthesia, obliteration of consciousness, becomes the ultimate good. I just don't want to know anything about my imminent demise. And so you can see the attraction, therefore, of euthanasia or assisted suicide, knowing that a doctor was going to make sure that I was just went out like a light. There's also, of course, the fear of indignity. It is interesting how this debate has changed. So back in the 1990s, when there was huge debates going on in the Houses of Parliament about legalizing euthanasia, the primary discussion was about pain and agony, people dying in terrible agony, crying out in agony. And the commonest diseases that were discussed were cancer, terminal cancer. But fast forward now, and the debate is still raging, but it's interesting, it's changed. Now, the discussion is not primarily about unbearable agony, physical pain. And it's notable that really all the cases which hit the headlines are not to do with cancer. They're to do with neurological diseases, neurodegenerative conditions, such as motor neurone disease, multiple sclerosis, spinal paralysis. These are conditions which don't in themselves usually cause severe and excruciating pain. But what they do is that they lead to loss of control. They lead to dependence. They lead to what people perceive as indignity. And so it's these fears, fear of indignity, fear of dependence, sometimes also a fear of overtreatment. Actually, I think that many people are terrified about falling into the hands of the doctors, the mad doctors, who are going to stick tubes in every orifice and keep me alive and keep me on an intensive care unit. I know that John Stott was very concerned about that, and that he asked if together we could write a document of his a statement of his wishes, so that if he became incapacitated, that he was treated appropriately and was not subject to massive medical overtreatment. So I think there's fear of that as well. But I think it's fear of dependence, which for many modern people is the greatest fear, the fear of becoming a burden. I remember seeing a poster from the campaign that was going on in Holland prior to the legalization there, and it showed this chap in a three-piece suit lying down into an open coffin, and it said underneath, "Everybody has the right to die like a gentleman." And so the idea of dying under your control, like a gentleman, it was seen as the ideal way. Next slide. For those of us who are Christian believers, the waters have been substantially muddied recently by two prominent bishops. One, Archbishop Carey, ex-Archbishop Carey, speaking in the House of Lords. Next slide. These are his words. "When suffering is so great that some patients, already knowing that they are at the end of life, make repeated pleas to die, it seems a denial of that loving compassion, which is the hallmark of Christianity, to refuse to allow them to fulfill their own clearly stated request, after, of course, a proper process of safeguards has been observed." Next slide. "If we truly love our neighbours as ourselves, how can we deny them the death that we would wish for ourselves in such a condition? That is what I would want." And elsewhere, Lord Carey wrote, "In strictly observing the sanctity of life, the church could now actually be sanctioning anguish and pain, the very opposite of the Christian message of hope. The fact is that I have changed my mind. The old philosophical certainties have collapsed in the face of the reality of needless suffering." So it's worth just reflecting on the words of Lord Carey. And I'm sure that actually Archbishop Carey is articulating what many Christians might be thinking, but just don't want to say it out loud. But it's interesting just to reflect about that. And I think to ask the question, why is it that at this particular point Lord Carey has changed his mind? I mean, it's not as though it's a new thing for people to die. And it's not as though it's a new thing for people to die in pain. And in fact, since the birth of the Christian church and Christian ministers have been at the deathbeds of people dying, and many of them dying in pain. And now, as has been already said, here we are in 2015, and the techniques that are available now for pain relief and symptom control are spectacularly advanced compared to anything that have ever been in the last 2,000 years. So why is it that at this point Lord Carey feels the argument now becomes overwhelming that we have to kill people to stop them suffering? And I think it must be, therefore, that it's not that the fundamental situation has changed. What has changed is our attitudes towards pain and suffering. But, you know, the argument from compassion is very, very slippery and very complex. To kill from compassion is, I would argue, is actually a form of oxymoron. I mean, it is an abuse of the term compassion. In order for me the so-called argument from compassion. I've got to agree with you that your life is worthless, and even to go on, it's actually a moral evil that you are continuing to exist. I mean, to put it in the crude words of the quality-adjusted life years, that you have a negative quality of life. Not just a zero quality of life, where you're sort of, you have equipoise about whether you carry on existing or not. If you have a negative quality of life, then actually every moment you carry on existing is just adding negatively to your experience. Therefore, somebody who kills you is actually doing you a favor. So not only do I have to conclude that about you, but I then also have to conclude that I have a moral duty to kill you, or directly assist you to kill yourself. And to argue that that is what compassion looks like is, I think, in most cases, extremely questionable. Next slide. And I've been very struck and helped by Joseph Piper writing on the nature of love. And he, this is really to extract and what he writes in great detail and subtlety, but in essence he says Christian love is a way of saying to another, it's good that you exist, it's good that you are in the world. And the interesting thing is that basically what assisted suicide and euthanasia is saying is the opposite. It's bad that you exist. It would be much better for the world if you didn't exist. But arguably, and I would, like Joseph Piper, I would say, I don't think Christian love can ever say that. Christian love can never say to another person, it's bad that you exist. However extreme the situation, it seems to me, Christian love says, it's good that you exist. It's good that you're in the world. That is the nature of love. Next slide. It is interesting that although in Holland, suffering, hopeless and unbearable suffering, is actually the bedrock of the euthanasia legislation. And in fact, I understand in Holland, it's not uncommon for a patient to go and see the doctor asking for euthanasia. And after assessment, the doctor says, I'm sorry, you're not suffering enough. Your suffering is not hopeless and unbearable. Therefore, you don't meet the criteria. You don't meet the threshold of suffering, and therefore I can't kill you. After a lot of discussion here in the UK, the Faulkner Commission, who were recommending what the future legislation would be, said the Commission has not recommended that any criterion based on unbearable or unrelievable suffering should be included in potential assisted dying legislation, as we are concerned that a criterion based on suffering would be too unclear and subjective for doctors to assess. So, in fact, in the proposed legislation, pain and suffering do not appear. They're not part of the criteria. They're neither necessary or sufficient. Next slide. So then there is the other argument. That's the argument from compassion. And here is the argument from autonomy. And Bishop Desmond Tutu came out again just before the big debate in the House of Lords last summer. Next slide. And these are his words. I have been fortunate to spend my life working for dignity for the living. Now I wish to apply my mind to the issue of dignity for the dying. I revere the sanctity of life, but not at any cost. And he went on to say that he believed that giving people the choice to end their lives was a way of ensuring that they had a dignified death. And so at the heart of this is the idea that every individual has the right to choose. And so much of modern Western liberalism goes back to John Stuart Mill, and here he is writing on liberty. The only part of the conduct of anyone for which he is amenable to society is that which concerns others. In the part which merely concerns himself, his independence is, of right, absolute. Over himself, over his own body and mind, the individual is sovereign. Now that wording is very significant, sovereign. This was at a time when the nation state was, the whole political theory about a nation state was being developed. And the theory was, within a nation state, within the borders of a nation state, the sovereign had the absolute right over the rules within that, within those borders. Once you cross the borders, then there were all the issues about international engagement and so on. And it seems to me that, consciously or unconsciously, John Stuart Mill is using the same analogy, as though each individual is really like a nation state. And within the nation state, you make your own laws. And you are sovereign. And no one but no one has the right to challenge the laws that you are making within your own state. Next slide. And so from this comes the concept of autonomos, the individual's right of self-governance. Literally, I make my own rules. I make my own laws. And so the argument from autonomy says every competent individual has the right to choose the time and the manner of their own death, irrespective of what other people want. So to many modern people, it seems utterly outrageous that we can control every other aspect of our lives. We can control where we live, where we work, how we spend our time, how we spend our money, how many children we have, who we marry, etc., etc., etc. The one thing that the law does not allow us to do is to choose the manner and the timing of our death. And this is outrageous, ridiculous, medieval. And so we must change the law to bring this last loophole, this last failure of control, into the right place. So it seems to me, in this secular liberal perspective, a good death is one which occurs at the time and in the manner that I choose. My dignity depends on the fact that I'm not dependent on others. I want to die without suffering and as a free and independent person at the time when I decide that my life is not worth living. Suicide is a rational and a reasonable choice, the ultimate example of self-fulfillment. I did it my way. I was the master of my fate, as that poem Invictus, which has become incredibly popular at the moment. It chimes with the zeitgeist. Next slide. And of course, there are other more ominous aspects around. Again, as other speakers before have said, it's naive to think it's just going to stop at assisted suicide for a small number of people who are currently going to Dignitas. And actually, in private, several pro-euthanasia campaigners have said to me that they see this as just the first step of a gradual liberalization of legislation, but that this is in order, you have to make a first step. And then once you've done that, then gradually you can start to liberalize it. These are the words of Mary Warnock. If you're demented, you're wasting people's lives, your family's lives, and you're wasting the resources of the National Health Service. I'm absolutely fully in agreement with the argument that if pain is insufferable, then someone should be given help to die. But I feel there's a wider argument that if somebody absolutely, desperately wants to die because they're a burden to their family or the state, then I think they too should be allowed to die. And that's Mary Warnock, very prominent moral philosopher who's been very influential in legislation. So I think, although when she said that, she called a howl of protest from most people working in the field of dementia, I think, again, she's verbalizing what many people think, but just feel it's politically unacceptable to say. And when you look at the demographic time bomb, you see the number of aging people. And I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, as I look around this room, I see the demographic time bomb in all its glory. And I'm part of it too. And so here we have this massively exploding aging population. We have an accelerating rates of dementia. We have the index-linked pensions that were referred to earlier. And how on earth are we going to afford this? And could it be that rehabilitating the idea of the noble, the rational, the responsible suicide, that this actually could be a solution, that you've had your life and, you know, you've done very well, but really now is the time to pass it on to the next generation, and you really don't want to go on burning up the entire estate and the pension and everything else, do you? So I think it's possible to see these, although it's hotly denied, of course, by people who are proposing this legislation. Next slide. So I like these words of H.L. Mencken. There's always an easy solution to every human problem, neat, plausible, and wrong. And I'm afraid that is what is being proposed. It's wrong. Next. So, as has already been discussed, it's interesting how the medical profession, of all professions, were those who differentiated themselves. In fact, many medical historians have pointed out to the Hippocratic Oath as really one of the first times at which this medical profession started to differentiate itself from the normal kind of magician stroke healer, which was very common in the ancient world. And in fact, if you go to many African countries, you can still find the medicine man. The medicine man is both the healer and the killer. You go to the medicine man if you're sick, and the medicine man will give you some potions. But if you want to get rid of your rival, someone who's having an affair with your wife, you go to the medicine man, and the medicine man will give you another group of potions for you to administer. And so you never quite trust the medicine man. And one of the worries when you go to see the medicine man is that your rival might have got to the medicine man first. How do I know this little bag of herbs, what they're actually for? And so the medicine man is a man of power, but one to fear and one to mistrust. And that is still true, I understand, in many African villages today. But the genius of the Hippocratic group was that they, for the first time, differentiated themselves publicly by saying, we will only use our technical professional skill to heal and never to harm. And so this is Margaret Mead, an anthropologist, writing about this. For the first time in the history of humankind, there was a complete separation between killing and curing. Throughout the primitive world, the doctor and the sorcerer tended to be the same person. He with the power to kill had the power to cure. He who had the power to cure would also be able to kill. With the Greeks, and she means the Hippocratic group, the distinction was made clear. One profession was to be dedicated completely to life under all circumstances, regardless of rank, age, or intellect. The life of a slave, the of the emperor, the life of the immigrant, the life of the defective child. And that's why, for 2,000 years, the medical profession has kept up this view of being totally dedicated to life only. So doctors would not go on to active service where they might kill people. They would refuse to participate in torture, in judicial execution, in abuse. Of course, there have been, I'm afraid, many cases where doctors have failed to keep to this ethical code, as we all know. But that idea that this was a profession dedicated to life is a very deeply rooted one in the profession. And that's part of the reason why doctors are so opposed to it. It strikes at the heart of why we went into medicine. And this wonderful and proud history that we share. So I, for one, feel that if you're going to legalize some kind of killing into society, then the doctors are the last people who should be doing it. And I would much prefer to see a Royal College of Euthanasiologists. It wouldn't take very long. It's actually much easier to learn to kill people. Killing people is easy. It's keeping them alive that's the difficult thing. So, it would only take a few months to train people to be effective killers. Why take the one profession which is dedicated to life and make them the socially accepted killers? And I do feel, for those of you who are doctors, we need, if, as I fear, this may well become legalized within the next 5 to 10 years, then there needs to be a resistance and a resilience from those of us who think this is not what we went into medicine for and not what doctors are about. Next slide. Just as an example of the effects on the medical profession, this is a picture. I happened to be visiting Holland, and there was a copy of their equivalent of the BMJ, and it was lying open. And I saw this cartoon, and I asked my Dutch friend what it said, and he translated it for me. And so it was just entirely plucked at random, and it shows a very elderly, debilitated lady in a tired junior doctor in a white coat, and she's saying to him, would someone visit me for a last bit of comfort? And he says, I'll call him to come, madam. And in behind you see death with the sickle. And I think it's just a sick, trivial joke. But the fact that that appears in a medical journal, I think is illustrative, just in a small way, of the way that once you have accepted that killing is part of medical practice, inevitably, that does lead to a change. Having said that, I went onto the website of the Dutch Voluntary Euthanasia Society not long ago and came across an account by a Dutch family doctor of his own practice of euthanasia. And he said he'd done it once or twice. He always hated doing it. He'd done it in his patient. When the patient started asking for euthanasia, he always tried to change the subject and said, let's not go there. But eventually, when we found that he couldn't avoid it any longer, he arranged for it to be done on a Friday afternoon. He would travel to the house, he would do the deed, he would inform the coroner and fill out the forms, and then he wrote, and then I go for long walks in the forest, I listen to a lot of Bach, I read Goethe, I try and get my head round what's happened and get ready for work on Monday morning. And so there is some deep, strange reaction. You know, this is not just a normal medical procedure. Something momentous has happened. Next slide. So what about Christian reflections? In Christian thinking, a human life is not just something that God gives to us, but it's actually in a mysterious way a reflection of his being, that as Christians are made in the image of God, we reflect his character. Next slide. And so in the famous verse in Genesis, where the taking of blood is prohibited, why? Because in the image of God has God made man. The ancient human taboo against the shedding of blood is specifically linked with the indwelling image of God. So in Christian thinking, intentional killing of an innocent human being is wrong because it contravenes a profound moral order which lies behind the structure of the universe and which is written in our hearts. This is something deep. And I would suggest that this deep kind of moral repugnance which doctors feel at the prospect, and which some doctors experience in killing people, is part of this moral order which is written in all our hearts. But as we've heard, of course, it's perfectly possible with repeated practice to overcome this moral repugnance. One of the interesting things is that doctors are trained to overcome repugnance, but it's an aesthetic repugnance, so that you have to learn how to overcome the repugnance of walking into the A&E department and seeing people covered in blood and awful aesthetic things, and you just have to learn to overcome your initial repugnance. The problem is, once you've learned to overcome repugnance, then you don't distinguish between what's aesthetic repugnance and moral repugnance. I've heard many doctors say, you know, I hate doing abortions, but, you know, you get used to it. Somebody's got to do, you know, sometimes in medicine you just have to do dirty things you don't like. But that's to confuse aesthetic repugnance and moral repugnance. Next slide, please. And it's interesting that in the biblical narrative and in all societies influenced by Christianity, suicide is never glorified as a noble or honorable way to die. You think of Saul and Judas Iscariot and the other examples we can think of in Scripture. They're examples of despair and hopelessness. And yet suicidal thoughts are actually quite common in God's people. Think of Elijah, who says, it's enough, God, let me die. But God doesn't say, okay, I'll take your life. Instead, he sends him on a sabbatical. I think of Job, who curses the day he was born, but discovers, has to learn more than the fact that God is in control of his life. So suicidal thoughts are actually quite common in God's people. And I have to be honest and say that I went through an episode of severe clinical depression, and I too was overwhelmed with suicidal thoughts and thought, really, it would do everyone a great favor if I could just end my life and everyone else could get on. But thank God that someone didn't turn up with a form and just sign here. But instead, I was met with love and with care and with healing. And I'm sure there are many people here, if you were honest, you've had moments of despair and you felt that your life wasn't worth living. So suicidal thoughts are not the same as saying that suicide is a good to be legalized and developed. Next slide. Gilbert Mylander said this: within the story of my life, I have the relative freedom of a creature, but it is not simply my life to do with as I please. Suicide expresses a desire to be free and not also finite, a desire to be more like the creator than creature. Next slide. And against the terrible individualism, the selfishness, which we see now in so much of this way of thinking, I think we need to reassert and redevelop this more ancient Christian understanding of what it means to be a community, what it means to be a society. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. So there is an idea that we are locked together. What you do affects me. What I do affects you. And as we are locked together as a community, then we have to recognize our mutual dependence. And so this is a quote that I don't know where it comes from, but I pass it on. The legal prohibition of killing is part of the glue that binds our society together. And once you weaken that glue, then you are weakening some of the most fundamental things which bind our society together. Next slide. And of course, there is this profound disconnect between, on the one hand, the government and the NHS and the prison service are spending millions and millions and millions on suicide prevention. And all doctors are trained in recognizing the risk of suicide and trying to minimize the risk of suicide. Prison officers, psychologists, counselors, so on. Police, we're all trained in trying to reduce suicide. Why? Because we recognize that suicide is a harm, that suicide damages all of us, and that it's not a healthy way for a society to be. And yet, at the same time, to have another group that are promoting suicide and trying to rehabilitate suicide as the new way to die, a responsible way to die, is just an example of the incoherence that we so often find in modern society. Next slide. And of course, as we know, again, any decisions made about legalizing suicide has to be done in the context of the real challenges there are about the care that elderly people. And will there be increased pressures on people who are getting poor care, less than adequate care? Suicide seems such an obvious and neat solution. Next slide. But I think perhaps one of the most profound issues is this issue of dependence. Because in Christian thinking, and actually in biology, dependence is not an alien, subhuman, undignified condition. It's part of the narrative of every human life. Every one of us in this room came into the world utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of someone else. You wouldn't be sitting there if somebody hadn't loved you and kept you warm and washed you and fed you and wiped your bottom. So we all of us come into the world utterly and totally dependent on others. We then go through this phase where other people depend on us. We've got three grown-up boys, my wife and I. But this phase of where other people depend on you seems to go on for a long time. The phone rings, Dad, Dad, Dad. Could you put £1,000 in my account, please? £1,000? Dad, can I borrow the car for a month? So this period of dependence, of other people's dependence, goes on for an awful long time. But, you know, most of us are going to end our lives utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of others. And that's not an evil, terrible, outrageous thing. No, it's part of the narrative of the life that God has given us. And I learned this with my own mother, who was struck down by a horrible form of progressive dementia. And towards the end of her life, she was doubly incontinent. She was confused. She was hallucinating. She could do nothing for herself. And near the end, I was visiting her, and somebody thrust a yogurt pot and a teaspoon into my hand. And I was saying, open your mouth, here it comes, open your mouth. And then I suddenly had this flashback. These are exactly what she used to do with me. and now the tables were turned. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, this is the way it was meant to be. I was learning more of what it meant to be a son, and she was learning more of what it meant to be a mother. Because dependence is part of the story. Dependence is part of the narrative. And for those of you who are Christian believers, you know, the story is even more wonderful, because the God, the universe himself, the God of total and utter autonomy and sovereignty, makes himself dependent, and he becomes a baby, and he can do nothing for himself, and he has to have his bottom wiped, and he has to be cared for and fed. And at the end, on the cross, with arms outstretched, the God of the universe says, "I am thirsty," and he can do nothing for himself. So God himself has entered into the experience of dependence in order to show us, you know, because what the Christian faith says is that his unique status as the second person of the Holy Trinity was in no way impaired or changed by his dependence, by his weakness, by his vulnerability. And so God has taught us and shown us in the person of Jesus that dependence is not in any way affect our dignity, our intrinsic value as loved princesses and princes of the Most High, to put it in romantic terms. So Paul says, bear one another's burdens, and so you will fulfill the law of Christ. And I think this idea that instead of this independence, I think we should try to celebrate mutual burdensomeness. And, you know, it would be lovely if the Christian community could be really countercultural on this, and that the Christian community was the place that lived out the reality of mutual burdensomeness. And yet I have to tell you that in conversations with many people, I find that many Christian people who would say, you know, I'm very happy to care for other people, I'm very happy to look after other people, but if I ever become a burden to anybody else, if I ever need looking after, I'm going to say to God, thank you very much, I've had my life, it's time to go to heaven now, goodbye. You know, and if you ever hear somebody saying that, or if you're ever tempted to say it yourself, you have to say, you are wrong. You are designed to be a burden to me, and I am designed to be a burden to you. And the life that God has given us is one of mutual burdensomeness. I'm running out of time, but I think that we don't want to imply that with excellent palliative care, people can just drift away into eternity, because the truth is there is suffering. Cicely Saunders talked about total pain, not just physical pain, but mental, psychological pain, relational pain, and spiritual pain. And someone approaching the end may well have this kind of total pain. And one of the quotes which came out of her movement was this: suffering is not a question which demands an answer. It's not a problem which demands a solution. It's a mystery which demands a presence. And so the privilege, and I speak personally, I'm sure as many other people here can say as well, the privilege of being the presence, of just being there with people who are suffering, is one of the most remarkable and wonderful privileges that we can have. Next slide. I think that, therefore, as Christians, we've got to see that both death is an enemy that we fight against. It's an evil which we're called to fight against. But at the same time, by God's grace, death can change into becoming a severe mercy, a strange kind of healing, a gateway to a new reality. Next slide. And so therefore, good medicine needs to know its limits. It must know when to say enough is enough. It must recognize the point at which death changes from an enemy to be resisted into an inevitable reality and a gateway to a new existence. And I think very often the problem with modern over-treatment is that doctors don't have the wisdom or the courage to be able to say enough is enough. And often they're driven by relatives who are. You know, one of the terrible ironies is that despite the wonderful work of Baroness Finlay and her colleagues, palliative care is still desperately underfunded and under-researched in this country. And yet, as a country, we pour literally billions into cancer research and into research, trying desperately to find some new even more effective treatment for cancer, to extend life even more by a few more months or years. And yet, what all of us are going to face, which is dying, is something which is not regarded as a high priority for funding, for research, for resources, and so on. And that's basically because of the public. It's because the public bang the table and say, we want better treatments for cancer. We want all our money to go into new research, into prolonging life. And very few people are banging the desk and saying, we want better pain relief. We want better palliative care. And as we've already heard, the art of good medicine is balancing the benefits and the burdens and risks of treatment, and therefore this kind of balancing is a complex and difficult task, and it's something which we need to try and involve relatives in. Part of our task is educational. This is the kind of thing which you need to have discussions amongst yourselves or with your nearest and dearest. If you were admitted to hospital with a terminal illness, would you want to have invasive treatment? Would you want to have, or would you prefer to be kept comfortable? I think it's very hard to have these conversations, but actually, if you're just faced with the crisis and you've never thought about it, it's far more difficult. And so I hope that this kind of conference can stimulate us to start having this conversation further on. I just close with this as an interesting but slightly alarming research. This is a paper that came from the States, and they looked at a group of patients, all with advanced cancer, who were predicted to have less than a year to live. And they divided them into according to the patients who used religious coping, that religious was important to them in helping them to frame their understanding of illness, and those who didn't use religion. And they then followed them to see what happened. Next slide. And what they found was that the patients who used religious coping, the majority of whom, this is the States, would be Christians, it was associated with an increased preference for heroic measures, lower rates of do not resuscitate orders, living will completions, and designation of a healthcare policy. Proxy. Positive religious coping was significantly associated with the receipt of mechanical ventilation and intensive life-prolonging care in the last week of life. In other words, the Christians were more likely to die on the intensive care unit having pointless heroic treatment and die with failed cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And when you say, why on earth? It's interesting reading the paper. There seems to be a whole sort of some people saying, well, of course, if you stop treatment, that's equivalent to euthanasia, isn't it? And or other people who were waiting for a miracle. And of course, if you stop having treatment, you know, it means that God isn't going to be able to do a miracle. So I really, you know, as part of my faith, I've got to go on to the ITU. I've got to have every possible treatment. So I think it just illustrates how much the educational challenge is and how much the educational challenge within the church is, to raise these issues and ask what is a good way to die? When is the right time to say enough is enough? And how do we live well and die well? How do we live faithfully and die faithfully? Thanks very much.